Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is actor, director, cosmic icon, Leonard Nimoy. Born in 1931, Leonard Nimoy was a jobbing actor, starting with 1951's comedy drama Queen for a Day. Among westerns and crime dramas, he made minor appearances in sci-fi stalwarts like Zombies of the Stratosphere, Them, and The Brain Eaters. He then moved to television, racking up dozens of guest appearances on shows like Sea Hunt, Dragnet, Highway Patrol, The Twilight Zone, Wagon Train, The Outer Limits, Combat, and The Lieutenant, which was created by Gene Roddenberry. We all know what happened after that. Roddenberry cast Nimoy as Spock in what was to be the first failed pilot for his sci-fi TV show, Star Trek. After the network commissioned Roddenberry to create a second pilot, virtually unheard of in the TV business, he jettisoned nearly everything about the show except for Nimoy. The rest is history. After Star Trek went off the air, Nimoy tried to shed his Spock persona. After a brief run on Mission Impossible, he co-starred as a ruthless killer in the 1971 Western Catlow and also made his first stab at directing with a 1973 episode of Night Gallery. After a memorable turn in the 1978 classic Invasion of the Body Snatchers, he returned to the role of Spock for six films, using his clout to get behind the camera to direct Star Trek III and Star Trek IV. As director, he had the biggest hit of his career with 1987's Three Men and a Baby, proving he could handle more than sci-fi horror action. Unfortunately, that promise went unfulfilled. Nimoy followed it up with the 1988 drama The Good Mother, which flopped. 1990's Funny About Love was similarly ignored by audiences. And Nimoy didn't direct again until 1994's Holy Matrimony, which barely got released. It proved to be his final film as director. Of course, as an actor, he returned to the role of Spock for J.J. Abrams' 2009 reboot, almost literally handing off the franchise to the new cast. He would make one final appearance on the big screen, again as Spock, in 2013's Star Trek Into Darkness. Who better to join me than to talk about the career of the great Leonard Nimoy than the host of Give Me That Star Trek, a show on this very network, Siskoid. Hi, Siskoid.
Hi, Rob. I can't believe you made me watch Into Darkness again.
I will lie. I just watched the scene with Spock Prime.
At some point, I thought I'd do the same, but then I said, well, no, I'll watch the whole thing. You know, I had the time. Although I did educate myself on Leonard Nimoy's career, watched a lot of his movies and TV movies that I hadn't seen this week. So, And I'm quite happy to have done so. So thanks for giving this opportunity.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there back in his filmography. As I've said on I think virtually every episode of Fade Out, part of the accidental appeal of the show I created is that it forces me to go back and dig through stuff that I would not normally see. I would not, you know, for any other reason, think to watch the 1971 Western Catlow starring Yul Brynner, but it's got Leonard Nimoy as an assassin. And so in that context, it was fun to watch. But I'd say we'll get to all that. Now, I've mentioned on other shows, I did at FW Presents with my pal Dan Budnick, where we talked about In Search Of. In my mind as a kid, Nimoy was equally Spock and the host of In Search Of. Like, I saw those two things were sort of equal in my mind because, of course, in the 70s, there were no Star Trek movies. It was just the reruns of the show. So therefore, it didn't loom as large the way it does now. It's like it's this whole big thing. But, when you were growing up, what was your history with Leonard Nimoy?
Well, it was Leonard Nimoy speaking French, probably, if we're talking about my earlier childhood, because I watched Star Trek in French originally, though those memories are all bundled up with the English version. Once you learn to speak English, which is around grade 3, grade 4 over here, you start watching the American channels, and, of course, Star Trek was on every night. On those channels, maybe just once a week on a French channel somewhere. But that ran concurrent with reruns or French reruns of Mission Impossible, on which he was also on for a couple seasons as Paris, sort of the replacement for Martin Landau. So I remember seeing him in that role as well, and always thinking, it's so weird that he's not Spock. So Spock was very much the first time I ever saw him. And In Search Of, though I've seen some episodes, some latter ones, did not loom as large because you don't get the sense that it's Leonard Nimoy if it's in translation.
Right. Yeah.
It's just narration. So, and I don't think we had that anyways as a translated show. But for me, it's Spock. And I went from the TV shows right into the movies, you know, as far as my memory is concerned. And he's remained Spock, you know, for many people. That is the iconic character that he created.
As a Star Trek expert, would you agree with the statement that of all the imagery to come out of all of Star Trek, Spock is the ultimate image of Star Trek? It's more than even the logo. It's Spock that anybody on the planet knows.
Yeah, the Spock or the Enterprise it is Spock, because even that image was used by sometimes illegally. There was like a Heineken ad campaign that Leonard Nimoy wasn't too happy about. Like, he saw that his image was, it's not just the character, it was him. So his image was being used, and sometimes Desilu or Paramount or whoever was owning Star Trek at whatever point weren't sending money his way, but also weren't getting paid for it. It's mm-hmm. just like, oh, Spock is just a pop culture thing, and anybody can use it. It's like in the public domain. It is certainly not. So it was one of the things that he held over the Paramount's heads concerning Star Trek The Motion Picture. That, you know, I'm not necessarily going to show up for your movie if I don't get paid these royalties or, you know, all this merchandising that is using my image, and we have no contract. And it's, you know, so he got that settled before saying yes to STTMP.
You know, reasonable. I mean, come on. Totally. You know, geez, you're gonna sell beer using my face with the Spock ears. The least I should do. I can't stop him from doing it, but at least I should do get a check out of it, for Pete's sakes.
Yeah, I don't think any other character is just the silhouette and the ears and the but a lot of that is Nimoy. You know, mm-hmm. it's like we've seen other actors play Spock, and still they don't quite have the sort of the facial structure mm-hmm. that he has and that has been reproduced in all these images.
You know what? That's a perfect segue, because one of the things I was startled by when watching some of his older films before he became Spock is his face is just very unique, like just very memorable looking guy. You know, I mean, it's just those hard lines on his face. When he shows up again in the Western Catlow, he plays a bounty hunter who's going after Yul Brynner's title character, and he just looks like. He just cuts such a distinctive figure in that film. I mean, the other stars are, like, again, I mentioned Yul Brynner, like Richard Crenna is in it. And there's a lot of other, you know, sort of famous people. But he's in all black. And he just, the minute he shows up, he looks like the figure of death in that movie. And he's not in it that much. And it's not a particularly great movie. But he is so memorable because he's just so distinctive looking. And so when you would watch him in movies before he became Spock, he just jumps out, and a part of it is because you know who he is at this point. You know, I mean, you're familiar with him, but still, I would imagine as a casting director in the young, you know, the olden days, and you're looking at these young actors, like, that guy he just pops. You know, he just kind of does. And even his voice, because I watched The Brain Eaters.
The Brain Eaters. He's unrecognizable in that.
Yeah, he's covered in mist. He only shows up at the very end of the film, and he sort of plays an alien that has taken over somebody's body. And you see him in this, you know, haze, but you hear his voice, and bam, you're like, oh, that's, wow. There's Leonard Nimoy right there. You can't tell, you know, you can't see him, but he's so incredibly distinctive. Now, you went back and watched, what was his earliest one? Zombies of the Stratosphere? Was that the first one?
I watched Satan's Satellites, which is the colored version, you know, just like a shortened colored version of that Republic serial. with the great name Zombies of the Stratosphere. He liked to joke, I remember I've seen interviews where he liked to joke that was that was his big, like, I played an alien, and I thought that was going to be my big break, and then you think he's talking about Star Trek. No, he's talking about Zombies of the Stratosphere. He's really kidding, because he's the second banana Martian. He's got like a green face.
Oh, wow.
At least in the colored version, you know. But, yeah, he, like, the other Martian has all the lines, and he's basically in the background. He's the henchman Martian, and you don't see him much. He's in very few of the chapters. So, I mean, he's kidding. He thought that was his big break. He thought Kid Monk Baroni was going to be his big break because he had sort of the lead in that, like, it's a boxing movie.
Yeah, he's the title role, right? He's Kid Monk Baroni in that.
Right. And then he realized that nothing came out of that, you know, basically because he's too slim. He said he was too slim figured to be a leading man. So he decided he wanted to be, okay, yeah, no, my role is going to be the supporting player. I've got the facial features and the build to be a character actor. And he saw himself as a sort of chameleon in that he could. So when you see him in The Brain Eaters, he's got this, you know, like the white beard and he's completely unrecognizable, but he was sort of seeking, he wasn't afraid of the makeup. So he was seeking these very different roles, transformative roles. And we can see how that got him to Mr. Spock eventually. You know, it's a similar idea that, okay, you get to play an alien, you get to transform yourself, you get to wear makeup. But he almost didn't take the job. He did the first pilot. If that pilot had been picked up, he would have been signed on for the show. But when they decided to do a second pilot, we need a new contract. So he wasn't sure he was going to do it at that point because he'd been getting some more, let's call it, serious work. He'd done a lot of theater, which is the stuff that we can't watch really, but he'd just come out with Death Watch, which is a Jean Genet play. Actually his second to be in a film. The Balcony is the other one. It's also a Jean Genet play. And that's very, I won't say serious in this. I mean, the Balcony is really a satire and a comedy, and Peter Falk is really funny in that, and so Shelley Winters, and even Leonard Nimoy, who comes in at the end, is funny in that role. While Death Watch is like a prison inmates, and it's really intense, but that had come out. He'd been in the play. He then got the rights. He and Vic Morrow, who's another actor, but who was directing this, got the rights for the movie. They produced Death Watch with that cast that Nimoy was in, and it had gotten some good reviews. So he thought to himself, okay, now I'm a serious actor. That just came out in 65. Even though it was not widely distributed, it was not widely reviewed, he still felt, okay, I'm on this track now. Now I'm a serious actor. Now I'm going after these art house projects or, important acting skill type stuff, which I would argue Spock is. But or he made Spock that probably like one of the reasons that character in that show became so, you know, popular and iconic is because he approached it from that perspective of the serious actor. So, but he almost didn't do it because he thought, you know, either I can pursue that or maybe I can do this Star Trek thing again. And he hadn't gotten a handle on it in the cage. So it took like a director at Star Trek in the new pilot to say, look, you know, you're playing off Shatner. And, you know, there's a big difference because Jeffrey Hunter is Captain Pike was so dour and serious and introspective. It meant that Spock had to do more because, you know, like the co-lead was also a little dispassionate. So with Shatner, who does a lot of emotional things.
Not an eternal actor.
Kirk, you know, Kirk is very emotive, but so Spock could like restrain it and become this, well, what became an icon. I don't think if Spock had acted the way he does in the cage, we would remember him as fondly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he has that quote about that, that when he was acting up against Jeffrey Hunter, he couldn't find a spot because Hunter, as you said, was so kind of internal and moody. And that's Spock's thing, kind of. But then he gets Shatner, and Shatner is the complete opposite of that. And all of a sudden, you've got this great contrast between the two leads as opposed to what. So, yeah, if the Star Trek had gone with Jeffrey Hunter, that show might have not succeeded. It might have gone one of those half-season deals, and it would have been forgotten. And
I mean, it almost was. You know, Roddenberry was always fighting the studio and fighting the network. So they were always trying. There's a reason that Star Trek eventually failed and did they put it in the wrong spots, you know, on the schedule is because they hated Roddenberry. Right. It wasn't because the show wasn't popular. It was getting good ratings. It was frequently first in its slot or sometimes or close second. It was doing well, but that, you know, they imposed more and more on Roddenberry because he was such a jerk to them. you know, it's that's just the way it goes. But Spock, or I mean Nimoy, within the show, quickly became very popular, especially with the ladies, which was a surprise to many, but makes sense in retrospect. And then so there was a little bit of infighting between him and Shatner at first, or Shatner felt a little wounded in his pride. They were withholding Nimoy's mail so that Shatner wouldn't realize that he was getting more than he was. I swear, you know, the fan mail wasn't coming in, and then suddenly, you know, they brought in boxes. They sent it directly to his home, to Nimoy's home. It was like cartons and cartons of letters. So it's so obviously there was an appeal, and Nimoy got 3 Emmy nominations for the role, and no other Star Trek has ever had an Emmy nomination for an actor.
Wow.
Ever. Not Patrick Stewart, not anyone. So it was, and at the time, you'd think that would have been even more surprising for a science fiction show.
Yeah.
To get those honors. And, you know, like Star Trek was nominated for Best Show that first year, but it lost out to Mission Impossible, also at Disney-Lou. So it's all kind of connected. But, you know, it was doing great things. And Nimoy was at the heart of it. You know, he renegotiated for his second season to actually have input in the scripts because he wanted more control over his character. So he really took this to heart. And we know him for having invented the Vulcan nerve pinch is his idea, the Vulcan salute is his idea. So he really put a lot into this character that wasn't necessarily on the page.
Absolutely. You know, there was a quote, and I have it in my notes, and I thought I would get to it later, but it's kind of a perfect place to bring it up here, is I read this quote from Gloria Steinem talking about Mary Tyler Moore. And her single quote about Mary Tyler Moore was, and this is Gloria Steinem's quote, "She's shit free." And what that meant was, at least how I interpret it was, is that no matter what Mary Tyler Moore did, even if she appeared in something that wasn't that great, you still liked her. She kind of came away unscathed from a lesser than great project because you got the sense that she was giving her all and you liked her. And it just didn't matter. Like, well, that didn't work, but it doesn't matter. I'll follow her to the next thing. And if you look through Mary Tyler Moore's career in the 70s, you know, the late 60s, after the Dick Van Dyke Show, she did a ton of movies that did no business at all. I mean, she did a lot of movies. They tried to make her a movie star. It didn't really work. Then they put her in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and that, of course, became a hit. And then after that, she did a bunch of variety shows, none of which went anywhere. And then she kind of recast herself as a film actor. So she kind of had these hills and valleys, but nevertheless, she remained beloved. And I think that way about Leonard Nimoy, is that Leonard Nimoy could appear in some Star Trek projects that are, I mean, he's in Star Trek V just as much as William Shatner is. Shatner gets the blame because he directed it. But you come away with this feeling of warmth towards Leonard Nimoy that you don't necessarily for William Shatner. You know, I mean, I guess some people have different opinions, but Nimoy was just so beloved across every project, everything that he did, that I think it's what you were talking about, that he is giving his all. You get the sense on screen, he's really caring about what he's doing. And I think the audience can pick up on that, even if the final project maybe isn't that great.
Yeah, but I'm reading These Are the Voyages series of books, which is really like the inside story of the making of the 3 seasons of the original series. And you get a lot of thoughts from the co-stars and guest actors and that kind of stuff about everything and about everybody. And one of the, there are really 2 Leonard Nimoys during the period of the Star Trek show. One is the sort of, well, one of the things he was doing was method. So he was Spock 24/7. So when he went home, it's like he had trouble with his family because he was unemotional. And he also said at some point that he carried that in his life all the time afterwards. You know, he played Spock so much that a certain withholding of emotion, because Spock doesn't not have emotions. His emotions are too powerful, so he always keeps them in check, and he's always working to keep them within. And then as an actor, that's an interesting thing where you have to be highly emotional, but always keeping it in, which is not the same as not playing emotion. So So there's the guy that, you know, like the guest stars sometimes would find him very remote, very difficult to talk to because he was Spock. He was Spock in between the scenes. He was Spock when he went home. He was Spock the next day when he woke up. And that caused some problems with people because he's so committed to the role. But then there are all these other stories that carry over from all the projects that he's ever done, not just the Star Trek ones. And it's how you use the word beloved, I think. That's really what it is, because he was such a nice person and always going to bat for other people, whether it's trying to get equal pay for Nichelle Nichols, for example, or when he was doing the Star Trek animated series.
Yeah, yeah.
He saw that George Takei and Nichelle Nichols were not part of the cast, and their characters were going to be voiced by other people. And he said, "Well, if those two aren't here, I'm not participating." And so he forced Filmation to, you know, reintegrate those actors. So, you know, he went to bat for people. And a lot of people remember that, and a lot of people talk about him in that way.
Well, again, that leads to another thing that I was fascinated by when I was looking over his career, is that, of course, by the time Next Gen comes along, those actors are, Star Trek is famous, and you know, it's a brand. Even though it was only the second show, but it was already a series of movies. Those actors knew the potential trap to their career, and they knew that going in, like, okay, I'm going to be able to, you know, use this as a springboard to other projects. I don't want to just be doing Star Trek the rest of my life. The original crew didn't really necessarily know that could happen to them, and for a lot of them, it kind of did. It sort of trapped them to where all they really could do was Star Trek. Now, I get the sense for somebody like DeForest Kelly, he didn't really care. I got the sense DeForest Kelly was just kind of like, I'll just do some Westerns. I'll do that rabbit horror movie. Whatever, it's fine. I'll just go home. And if you need me to be McCoy again, I'll come back. But I get the sense that Nimoy was really the only one that looked at his position, his value to Star Trek as a thing, and said, okay, I am going to use this to springboard out of other things into other things. And that's, to me, I was shocked to know that his directing career started in 1973, like I mentioned, with that Night Gallery episode. I had no idea. I had always heard that the first thing he ever directed was Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. But that was his first movie. But
movie,
he directed
yeah.
actually a bunch of television. I did not know that until I started researching this episode. So as early as 73, he's already sort of setting his sights and saying, well, look, I can pivot this and do it, because he's not in that episode of Night Gallery. It's just, he's just directing it. And I can imagine they would have said, geez, you know, we'd like you to be in it because you're a name. No. He's just the director in it. And I thought that was, he always seemed to be able to say, I have a certain amount of power here and I can use it for my own career. And like you mentioned with the animated series, using it in a good way there, he's helping his friends get a job, which they should have. They're glad they were used in that show. But I always thought that seemed like a really savvy negotiator about how to manage his own career, to say, hey, there's other things I want to try, and I have this certain amount of fame, I have a certain amount of name recognition, and I'm going to use it. And I always thought even Shatner probably, you know, Shatner continued to work because he was always going to be a name, but I get the sense Shatner didn't, I don't, I could be wrong, but I just get the sense that Shatner was more like, is there a leading man part? I'll do that. As opposed to Nimoy, who was able to say, well, I'll play a villain here, or I'll direct this episode, or whatever. And of course, then he worked with even Shatner directing episode of T.J. Hooker.
Yeah.
which is amazing. That, boy, I would love to hear like the audio of that, you know, of what that would have been like for him to work on, you know, them working together in that context. But I mean, he did lots of other neat stuff. Now, unfortunately, some of it is hard to find, because a lot of it were TV movies that are, you know, you have to, if they're not on YouTube, they're a little hard to find. Now, did you watch, I forget, you sent me the list. Did you watch Baffled? Have you seen that one?
I'd watched Baffled before.
Okay.
at some other point. But, you know, so that was him trading on his science fiction fame, genre fame in a way. And it kind of feels like a pilot for a
it
show about a psychic
pilot. Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't, it didn't work out, but you know, it's fun because YouTube does have a lot of these TV movies. And at time to time, I watch a TV movie, because I've created like a list of films that I have to see because there's an actor in them, or because it's a certain theme, or whatever reason. And because YouTube has it, Because normally you'd say, well, that's going to be low production value. It's going to be, you know, the acting's going to be a little soap opera maybe. But the ones that I watched like this week, no matter what, Nimoy is good in them.
Yes.
And yes. And it sort of elevates the piece, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. So, but it's a little bit like, oh, you're watching Columbo and he's the, you know, there's one episode where he's the murderer. And so just about the only Columbo where Columbo loses it against the villain. And it's that one. It sort of brings out the emotions in others, right? And sometimes you kind of feel that Nimoy is maybe a little pigeonholed in some of these roles as the man withholding emotion. You know, he becomes an expert in that. But I would also say that the value of being able to withhold emotion in a role is when you crack and actually bring out that emotion that is hiding underneath, then suddenly that moment is much more spectacular, interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. It happened in Star Trek. The first time he kind of cracked the character, he was told to, like, he was, I don't know, he was supposed to say fascinating in the Corbomite maneuver, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's like moments like that where the director once told him, no, do less. You know, you don't need to be as wired as everybody else on the bridge because you don't process emotion the same way. So that brought on the minimalism of Spock just raising an eyebrow. Mm-hmm. You know, just raising an eyebrow. And when you see it in movies before Star Trek, it's fine. It's like, oh, the Spock eyebrow. But just like being able to raise an eyebrow and that says everything that the character wants to say is amazing. It's an amazing opportunity to do a lot with very little. Mm-hmm. And if you withhold emotion, then, you know, you're not wasting any. So just those little cracks can have a lot more meaning than if you're emoting all the time. Mm-hmm. And you see that in those TV movies, like he plays like the cold doctor, or he plays the villain who is very cold, or, you know, or the man that has to hold it in because the world's against him, stuff like that he plays. And or scientists, and we've, you know, sometimes it's kind of, okay, you're doing a science type in a movie because you were Mr. Spock at some point. It can feel like that. So it may be like he's a little pigeonholed in a way, but he brings this whole box of tools, you know. It's like, even though that is maybe an echo of Spock, I know he also played Sherlock Holmes mm-hmm. in theater through the 70s, and it's like, well, okay, Sherlock Holmes and Spock are related.
Sure.
Yeah, they even say so in Star Trek VI, which I think is an inside joke about that run, that theatrical run. But
you think that was the reference?
I think it is.
The quote about an ancestor of mine.
Yeah.
Insists that the possibilities, whatever, the most remote, whatever. I'm butchering the quote, but
whatever it is.
Yeah, I caught it. I was like, that's a Sherlock Holmes quote, but he doesn't say it in the movie. He doesn't say this is from Sherlock Holmes. So okay.
But he'd famously played Sherlock Holmes on stage for a good run or whatever it is. So a famous run. So I'm thinking, yeah, okay, that's on purpose. But yeah, so these characters are kind of all the same, you know, similar color. But that becomes his expertise in a way.
I do wonder, he did, of course, his probably most other famous movie role is Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978. Yeah. That's a masterpiece. It gives the lie to the idea of that, oh, you shouldn't remake good movies, you should remake bad movies. No, because the 50s movie is a classic, and then they remade it, and they remade it again as a classic. And he's great in it. He is just marvelous. And the very next movie he did was Star Trek TMP. And it makes me wonder, like you were saying with Death Watch, I wonder if Body Snatchers could not have led to more things had not he then been Spock again right afterwards. I wonder if that could have been a bigger thing for him. I mean, we'll never know. But I thought he was so great in that movie, so creepy and unctuous and, insulting and weird. He's got that weird hand glove thing that he wears. I mean, he is mm-hmm. really terrific in that movie. And it's almost like, I don't want to say it's a shame because the guy had a marvelous career, beloved and made a lot of money and got to, you know, see what an icon he became. But I do wonder, boy, I wonder if that could have led to something else, because he's just terrific in that movie.
Yeah, I wonder, because it is kind of low on the bill in terms of the roles, right. You know, who's, but you know, they went and picked somebody who was already recognizable and famous to play the role, you know, to just give it a little more oomph.
Yeah.
And it certainly worked out. But you're right. If, like, suddenly you're back on the Star Trek bandwagon, although all through the 70s he'd been making appearances as Spock or as Leonard Nimoy, the actor who plays Spock. You know, one of the themes of his career, especially when you go back to the 50s, is that he'd do anything to support his family. You know, he took on every dumb role, every stupid job on the side.
A lot of personal appearances in places.
Yeah, and that eventually, I mean, ironically, that led to, like, you know, the collapse of his marriage. But still, he was doing it to bring in the money, you know, no matter what. So he took on a lot of those, yeah, public appearances and whatnot. So he was always on that Spock bandwagon, in a way. He never got off after 1966.
Yeah.
So when the movie came out, I mean, he was still threatening not to be in the movie.
Yep.
So he was ready to, you know, he's often done this. You know, there's been always points where he said, I'm not, you know, like second season of Star Trek, I'm not coming in unless these demands are met. So he was always playing chicken with the producers. So he did it again with Star Trek, the motion picture. Mm-hmm. And then after the motion picture, he said, well, write me out.
Yeah, kill me off, right? Yeah.
Kill me off. And then he's coming back, but I'm only coming back if I can direct it. You know, he's always, there's a lot of blackmailing going on.
But, well, you
need Spock, right? That's exactly to the point that you brought up at the beginning of the show. Spock and Star Trek are, you know, they're synonyms. They're, yep. You need one without the other. You know, they are linked. And if you'd had the original crew in a movie and not Spock, that it would have tanked the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't work. Yep. And then you can kill him and then say, well, we're not going to have him again. And you can believe that. But of course, they bring him back. But no, even shows up in TNG at some point. You know, like mm-hmm. he's often going in and at least giving his seal of approval to the new version. Which he also did with the Kelvin Timeline films. So I think that's very gracious of him, considering that he's so often, you know, bluffed with Spock as the stakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, because Nimoy's acting career and his directing career intertwined, it wasn't like he did one and then the other. I do want to talk about some of his directorial films. But before we get to those, though, I do just want to spend a minute on Seizure, the story of Kathy Morris, because yeah. The title is terrible. I mean, the title makes it sound like a Lifetime movie.
The real title. I mean, it's the title of the book, but the title should have been Headstrong, not Seizure, because that is the only characteristic the character of Kathy has.
Right.
This is very headstrong. And I think it fits the idea that he's a neurosurgeon and but he's excellent in that.
He is great. That was the thing. I was going through his movies and I saw this and I was like, well, let me see if this is on YouTube. Oh, geez, it is. Let me try it. So I put it on and it opens. It plays. You know, it's a TV movie about a woman based on a real story. A person who, and it was a famous story at the time of a woman who had these crippling seizures and got this sort of not experimental brain surgery, but very risky. Of course, any brain surgery is risky, but got this brain surgery and barely came out of it and had to relearn language and how to talk. And so it was in the news and people knew who this Kathy Morris was at the time, which is why you would put her name in the title. Of course, you know, 40 years on, it just reads such a cheesy kind of title. But I watched it and I was like, this is actually really good. And Nimoy is great in it. And it's the kind of thing where I'm like, God, if they had not given it this title, I don't know, maybe nowadays it just wouldn't read so kind of silly, but he's great in it. And the scenes in the surgery are, first of all, surprisingly graphic. I was not anticipating giant close-ups of Nimoy as the surgeon, you know, like hacking away at this person's skull. But that's the scene where he goes and gives her the brain surgery and then something goes wrong and no one knows what. My heart was like in my throat. I was like, this is actually really good. And the fact that it was the first thing he did after Star Trek, the motion picture, I thought he probably could have held out for more movie roles, but I thought he was kind of just going after things that I guess maybe he thought were interesting. And he is really terrific in that movie.
I think he's really after a lot of projects that speak to him personally. There's a lot of projects that have to do with Jewish affairs, let's say, as well. And he's produced some stuff. I mean, if we're going to name a couple of TV movies that or TV projects that are on YouTube and are worth watching, there is that one. There is Vincent, which is a one-man play that he wrote and produced and directed for television and is the sole actor in. And that's on YouTube as well. It's about an hour. It's about Van Gogh's brother, who is kind of giving the eulogy for Van Gogh.
Right, he plays Theo, yeah.
Yeah, but also he's playing Vincent. You know, it's like he's telling stories about his brother, but then he's also incarnating that character. And it's funny. It's kind of touching. It's interesting to art history. So I would recommend that. And there's one from the early 90s, Never Forget, which is one where he plays it's a true story because TV movies are so often true stories, but it's the true story of an Auschwitz survivor who lost his entire family. But then, in the current day, which is supposed to be 1980 or so, as the true story goes, there was like this white supremacist group who harassed him. And then he said he could prove that the Holocaust happened. Anyway, he's supposed to defend the Holocaust, or defend the historical accuracy of the Holocaust, which is still an issue that sort of is here today with white supremacy. And again, he's very, very strong in that role, very natural with the family. All the stuff with the man's family seems very, very, very natural, almost improvised. And again, he's someone who has to withhold a certain amount of emotion because he's so outraged and so broken by his past, having been a teenager in those camps. So I'd say, well, like those are like some great TV movies, but they're always very personal. Mm-hmm. To him. So I wouldn't be surprised if the story of Kathy Morris, Seizure, was also something personal to him. It was also something that spoke to him in some way or that he had a personal connection to.
Yeah, and then there is the whole kind of cold angle because there's this thing about that he's such a devoted surgeon that he's sort of ignoring his wife. That's the other subplot, is that he's letting his marriage fall apart, which, as we know from his real life, maybe that's something that spoke to him. Is that there's this scene where he deals with Kathy, and she's she's obviously in a really bad situation, and he comes home. He's his wife has made dinner, but it's like late at night, and the dinner's cold, and he sort of says hello to her, and then immediately goes into his study and starts looking at his papers to figure out what to do next. And the wife is just sort of looking at him like, "You've been gone all day, and like now you're already and you know." It is, that's a little Spock-like, but then he does, as you mentioned earlier, he does have that one part where he sort of explodes in a good way, where she starts to wake up and he sees a little bit of reactions in her pupil, and he's like pounding her chest. He's like, "Kathy," and he slapped. And like I said, it's one of the things where I just sat and I went into it kind of feeling, all right, this is going to be sort of cheesy. And then as I watch, he's terrific. And it's good on you, Leonard Nimoy.
There's a strong procedural bent to the whole medical story, but then there's also like they've built this arc for his character, not just for Kathy's, but for his character through healing her. He's kind of healing himself. The relationship he doesn't have with his wife is a relationship he doesn't have with his patients until Kathy, who draws him in because she's so beguiling in a way. Mm-hmm. So, and then learning to connect with her means he can now connect with others, including his wife, maybe. So, I thought there was like at first I thought, why are we looking at these soap opera subplots in this? But eventually it all comes together. So yeah, I'd say that whether or not it is a TV movie and it is your inspirational story of the week kind of thing. It is that. It also is elevated by his presence. I think it's got a better script than most, but it's also elevated by his acting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You could imagine that movie with, 100 other TV actors that would just make it forgettable. But his presence just makes it really stick out. So, as we mentioned, he went on to direct, TV episodes. He did The Powers of Matthew Starr. Everybody remembers that show. And then he did, as I mentioned, he did a T.J. Hooker. And then he moves on to Star Trek III, his first film. Now, I, you know, despite, God, we've been on the same network now for 6-7 years now, Siskoid. I don't know if I really know your opinion about Treks 3 and 4 as films. Where do they loom in your personal headcanon of Star Trek projects?
Well, I'm slowly planning a watch party of certain Star Trek films here at the house. You know, we're always doing, you know, whenever it's a family day, it's something we can, we get a day off for. That weekend, we usually do a sort of run of, we do like all the Indiana Joneses this year. So next year, I'd love to, I don't know, it always feels like I'm pushing Star Trek onto people. And I don't like to do that. But I'd love to do the Star Treks, except I don't want to do the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do TMP, and I don't want to do 5. So to me, I 2, 3, 4 is the prime, the best cut of Star Trek there is. You know, those three movies are just one story, and they're great. So there are great moments in 3, even though it's a little weaker than 2 and 4. I think 4 is, you know, in the top 3, with along with my personal favorite is 6. I'm not ready to say it's as great a movie as 4 or 2 or First Contact for me, but it's like kind of my favorite for personal reasons. But still, I think 4 is a lot of fun, and I think 3, I mean, Destruction of the Enterprise, Krug, you know, there's a lot of really cool stuff in 3 that and a lot of great acting. I think that if Nimoy has anything to do with the acting of the other actors as director, look at Shatner in that one. There's some really powerful moments.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said that I think you get a great Uhura moment in that movie. And, you know, I mean, like all the actors get, I think, a little moment. And that had to be partly from Nimoy, is that, you know, he knows. He's like, okay, you know, I want to make sure I give these my fellow actors I've been working with for, you know, 20 years at that point, all a little something to do, a little extra something. I love Star Trek III. I think its deficiencies are a little bit on the script side and certainly on the budget side. For whatever reason, like I think Nicholas Meyer was maybe able to hide the lack of budget on 2 a little better than on 3. I think part of the problem with 3 is we have to follow the storyline with David that to me is just not quite as inherently as interesting. But as a directorial effort, I said Nimoy, he does it. He kicks it, as Shatner says in the Star Trek Movie Memories book. He kicked that movie's ass. I mean, he really did, and it led him into 4. And as everyone knows, 4 is one of my favorite movies of all time. Period.
Right.
I just think famously, absolutely, it brings me joy every time I watch it, and it has such a confidence to it that he was able to, you know, he could trust the audience to inject this level of humor in it, to know that after 2 movies of everything being so death and destruction and, you know, Spock dies and David dies and the Enterprise is destroyed and no, now we're going to lighten it up and we're going to stick these jokes in it and how much it made it work. It's just, and it's, you know, I guess it was the fact that Nimoy was off doing other films, that he was never going to do 5. That was never going to be, you know, it was always planned to be Shatner. It does sort of seem frustrating that you're like, boy, just let Nimoy do the rest of them. I mean, he clearly had a knack for it.
Yeah. Well, I think Jonathan Frakes did kind of the same thing in the TNG movies, where his movies are well-directed and fun, as well as exciting. Even Insurrection, which people don't like, I think directorially has a lot of going for it, and First Contact is great. And then he didn't translate that into a great directing career either, except on television. On television, he's directing, you know, all the science fiction shows, and you can actually tell that, okay, yeah. So he's a great television director, but it didn't really translate as a movie director beyond Star Trek. Nimoy kind of it has a similar career path here, or, you know, started it. But, I've heard him say that Star Trek III, they were always on his shoulder. They were always, questioning everything. He had to prove every concept he was trying to, everything he needed to do, he wanted to do. He had to be checked by everybody else. They didn't trust him with the movie. And then 4, that one was successful. So 4, they took the handcuffs off and you can do whatever you want. So there is a freedom there, and there's a confidence there that comes from just being allowed to do it. And I think he already had the antecedents. You know, he directed plays and television enough, I think, to know what he was doing. But I'm still surprised that, Star Trek IV, success. Star Trek III was a success. IV, success. And that doesn't turn him into a director of either blockbusters or science fiction. Mm-hmm. That turns him into a director of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
which is obviously part of Star Trek IV, but I wasn't expecting his career to go that direction necessarily based on that. It's like, that's not the component I would have thought, but yes, if it works as a comedy, which Star Trek is not normally a comedy, so for it to work as a comedy, you got to do something right. Yeah. And then that sends him into projects. And I think it's telling that The Good Mother was a drama and not a comedy, and that flopped. And then that sort of took him on a downward spiral. Hollywood really, really harsh in terms of giving people chances. It's like you do a couple back-to-back blockbusters, science fiction blockbusters that do really well. Star Trek IV was the best, I think, the one that did the best, right, of all the series.
Yeah, it's the most successful of the Star Trek, original Star Trek films, the biggest box office success.
Right. And then... And then Three Men and a Baby is the highest grossing film of 1987. And then you only just one flop.
That's it. Yeah.
Diane Keaton destroys his career.
Well, what?
I don't know what happened there. So
I feel like that has changed, that now you can get a couple of flops and you just keep going. But man, back then, yeah. I mean, it's like you look at that and you say, he does two Star Trek installments, both of which are success. And the fourth one, again, is the biggest hit, which completely countermands the normal trajectory of sequels making less than the original film. And then he moves on. He says, okay, I'm going to do something completely different and do this family comedy. And that, as you say, is the biggest hit of the year. Imagine that, 1987 is the biggest hit of the year, Three Men and a Baby. And then he just makes The Good Mother, which, again, with Liam Neeson, Diane Keaton, and it's a flop. Now, I don't know. The Good Mother could not have cost that much money to make. I mean, what was the budget on The Good Mother? $100 million? No. So it's like, okay, that was a flop, but okay, like, give him something else. And then he doesn't direct another movie until Funny About Love with Gene Wilder, which I saw in the theater, which is not a good movie. Then that flops, and then that's kind of it. I mean, we'll talk about his final film in a moment, but the directing career was essentially over at that point, which seems really shocking.
Yeah, who knows what was happening in behind the scenes and who he was actually friends with in studios that then didn't have a job and so he wasn't getting the work. Who knows? I mean, there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on behind the scenes that we're not necessarily privy to until they do the movies that made us or whatever
right.
to tell us the behind the scenes. But Three Men and a Baby shows, well, it does show that he can work with kids and actors and combine kids with actors, even though this is a baby. The baby is not acting per se, but still that's a recurring motif. I think that we see in later work, working with children, either as an actor or as a producer or actor or a director. So, he shows that. And I think the movie is Two Men and a Baby.
Did you rewatch it? I have not seen it.
Oh, I did rewatch it. I'm surprised that this was such a big hit in a way and not, because the three actors, although today we'd say that's a very odd trio of actors.
Gutenberg, Tom Selleck, and Ted Danson.
Well, Tom Selleck was on his last year of back in PI.
Yeah.
So this movie was made for my mom. It's Tom Selleck interacting with a cute baby. Like, I remember my mom being over the moon about this. It's the content that she craves. And then Ted Danson was still doing Cheers, and he's right, kind of playing Sam Malone in this. And Steve Guttenberg was just, it was at the end of his Police Academy movies.
Yep.
And then they would go on without him. And then Cocoon was also in there. So he'd been off a couple of successful, we're not going to say that was, Police Academy is never going to be a great classic, but it was fondly remembered and people did follow that series. So it makes sense in this. He's obviously the weakest player in the group. But I was surprised about, there's a crime plot in it. There's a whole heroin. Oh,
that's right. There's like a drug angle. That's right.
That's very strange. So, you know, it's like, it's for everyone. You know, the ladies are going for Tom Selleck and Ted Danson, and then the cute baby, maybe the mothers are going for the cute baby. The boys are going for the crime, you know, they're okay, there's a crime plot. I'm good. Or whatever people had it like as a mindset in the 80s, there was something for everyone in this, you know, and it's quite sweet and charming, really. I mean, it's not, it may see it's dated in a way, but it's not actually too bad. You know, and they don't do the thing where they would hate to have a baby like for too long. Mm-hmm. They hate the baby for like 5 minutes. Yeah. And you know, and that's it. And then after that, they're all in love with the baby and you're in love with the baby. So it works as a comedy. I would say it works as a comedy, but then, and I can understand how it was a hit, but also 1987 was not a good year for film.
Right. Yeah.
That was the year or part of the year that I was doing movie reviews for television as a teenager. The teenager's take on movies. And you should see the list of films that were out that year. Outrageous how bad they were. Sorry, but it's true.
Oh, well, we're just a couple years out from Batman, and then everything sort of changes at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah. God, they made a sequel to Three Men and a Baby, Three Men and a Little Lady, which I saw in the theater, for God's sakes. I don't know why I did, but okay. He did not direct that. So yeah, he does this Funny About Love, which is really not, did not work, and apparently features, obviously was edited severely, kind of out of his hands, because Farrah Fawcett was in that movie, and they completely edited her out of the film, and that always suggests, you know, there's a kind of chaos if you can edit out an entire character out of a movie and nobody really knows. So really did not work.
Wow.
So then 4 years later, he directs this movie called Holy Matrimony. And I'll just briefly relate the plot of this film. It's about a couple of crooks named Havana and Peter, and they rob a carnival that they work in, and then they go on the lam. They hide out in a remote Hutterite community that the man grew up in, where they marry to satisfy the community elders. When Peter is killed in an accident, Havana sticks around so she can find where Peter hid the loot, and then she is betrothed to Peter's young brother Zeke. Excuse me. When Zeke finds the money, the Hutterite elders have him drive with Havana to the U.S. to return it, where she has to pretend she doesn't know where the money came from. Meanwhile, the police are on Havana's trail. Havana is played by Patricia Arquette. Zeke is played by a very young Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Peter is Tate Donovan. Wilhelm is played by Armin Miller-Stahl. John Shuck plays the cop named Markowski, and Richard Reel plays Greason, the carnival owner. The screenplay is by David Weisberg and Douglas Cook, who wrote The Rock,
right,
for Michael Bay, and a movie Criminal with Kevin Costner, among other films. Now, I remember getting this. I worked at the video store, Movies Unlimited, when this movie came out. And I remember getting the box and looking at it and seeing that it was directed by Leonard Nimoy. And the box is terrible. It just looks like junk. And I remembered thinking, why would Leonard Nimoy waste his time with this junk? And I never saw it. And then I watched it for this episode. And look, it's not a great
movie. As did I.
Yeah. It's not a great movie, but it's a real movie. It's not a direct-to-video junk the way The Box suggests it. And so with its religious angle, I could see that Nimoy would have been interested. He was a man very interested in religion, his own and others. So I could see why he would why this had appeal for him. Again, it's not a great movie, but it's better than the video box at the time suggested. So what did you think of it when you saw it?
Well, I mean, it's the kind of story that when you look at it on paper, you think that probably should not have been attempted. You know, Patricia Arquette marries a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, right there. And you're like,
Joseph Gordon-Levitt gets his first, it's his first feature film role, but it's also his first on-screen kiss, you know. how could it not be? So, despite the kind of premise that makes you squirm in your seat, it doesn't go too far. It's more of a, you know, it's a cute relationship, a brother-sister kind of relationship where she's like a mentor and almost. They both learn from one another, as you might expect. I mean, it's kind of a predictable film despite the premise. And again, there's a crime element, even though it's supposed to be a twinned fish-out-of-water story.
Mm-hmm.
Like Three Men and a Baby, it's cute. It's nothing to write home about really, but it works on its own terms, I would say. Mm. And again, I think it's probably because of the actors. I think the two leads are so good, and it doesn't make fun. You need to think, okay, well, what is the joke here? Are we laughing at this Hutterite colony and their religious mores? Are we laughing at that? Not really.
Yeah, it's no, just, not at all. Yeah,
no, it's like we create a situation that has humor in it, or possible humor. But even the colony is going like this. This is going. We can't let a woman marry a 12-year-old child. Like sure. The scriptures may say it, but not. That's not what they mean. But you know. Whatever, that's the situation. So even they are not lampooned. So I thought, yeah, that was like a very respectful way to do the story, even though, yeah, on paper, you know, don't do that. That's just, it's just making me frown. But these are very strange projects to get attached to. Mm-hmm. For Leonard Nimoy, but you also see how it relates to other themes in his career, you know, in other things that he's done or chosen to do.
Yeah, completely. Except it was nice to see John Chuck show up, because of course he played the Klingon in Star Trek IV. You know, so I have to feel that that's you know, he was
that's how they met.
Yeah, that's how they met. You know, I mean, I love him in Star Trek. There shall be no peace as long as Kirk lives. I mean, just absolutely love him in that movie. So it was nice to see him show up here. But yeah, that was something that you could see in lesser hands, a movie about a Hutterite community, which for people who don't know, a Hutterite is sort of an analogous to like
it's like a German Amish. Yeah.
Except are they specific to Canada? Is that why? Is that what makes them hotter? Because they're in the movie, they're in Canada.
They're in Canada, and I think it's probably like Saskatchewan or Alberta or something, because that's not around here. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what that is.
Okay. I didn't know if Hutterites were specific to, you know, one region or whatever. But yeah, you say in lesser hands. The Hutterites could be an object of ridicule that, oh, look, they don't believe in electricity. Isn't this funny? Ha ha ha. And that's not at all what it is. Yes, there is, as you say, the fish out of water element, because Havana, played by Patricia Arquette, is, you know, she's not only a criminal, but she's kind of like, she dresses in like little short shorts and has like, so she, you know, cuts a very distinct figure among the Hutterite community. But it's never played as, oh, these people are backwards. And again, we know that Nimoy took religion, his own Judaism and other people's religion very seriously and was interested in it. And so you could see this screenplay as something that would attract him. Now, again, I think the ultimate result, it's a little too silly. It's a little too wacky. There's a little too much of cute Joseph Gordon-Levitt kind of saying funny things. Oh, it's a little kid saying these funny things. Ha ha ha. And it's got a little kind of a corn pone sort of thing to it. But unfortunately for Nimoy, it was just buried. And I found this quote on IMDb about it. And unfortunately it doesn't, I'll read the quote. It says, when asked by an interviewer about his next movie, he told them that Holy Matrimony was due soon. Unknown to him, Disney had already given it a limited release and subsequently shelved it. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't say who the him is in this quote. Are they talking about Joseph Gordon-Levitt? Probably not. He was a little kid and probably not Tate Donovan, and he wasn't much of a name. So I'm assuming the him in this quote is Nimoy, because who else would be famous enough to be asked about it? And the fact that Disney just basically released it and didn't just put it in a couple of theaters and then just pulled it. And as I said, shoved it on home video with this sort of horribly photoshopped box, which again, just made it look like junk. That's a shame. That's a real shame. And I can only imagine if you work really hard on a movie and you take it seriously and you try and make the best movie you can, and then it just gets dumped. That's got to be incredibly disappointing. And that ends up being his final film. Now, he did direct one episode of a TV show in a year after, but as a film director, that was it. He was done at that point.
Yeah. When your movie can be now found on YouTube for free.
Yeah.
But it was not, it is still not, you know, the rights still belong to some.
Yeah.
But they allow this.
Yeah. That's Disney doesn't even care.
No. So it's pretty bad, but the film is better than that, you know, that the DNA might suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, at that point, then he kind of just goes back to being an actor. And of course, he used his incredible voice to great effect. I mean, he had that wonderfully deep, gravelly voice. I mean, we all know he plays Gravitron in the Transformers movie. Now, I would never be forgiven by some of the listeners out there.
You're still going to be forgiven because it's Galvatron.
Oh, Gal. Sorry. I even had it in front of me and I said it wrong. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Graviton.
Sorry about that, everybody. He did two appearances on The Simpsons, where he is absolutely hysterical. Marge versus the Monorail and the Springfield Files. There's a great anecdote from, I think it was the Springfield Files episode, where he really does, obviously had a great sense of humor about himself. I mean, he allows himself to be called Spock in the episodes, the Simpson episodes, that he beams out at one point, you know, the classic, you didn't even do anything, didn't I? And then he beams out of Springfield. But I think it was one of the producers who said that when he got the script for the Springfield Files episode, which is the X-Files parody, he sings in it. And apparently when he got the script, he gets to that point and then he looked at, I think it was Al Jean, the producer, and he goes, I know what you want. Which I thought is very funny that he had that sense of like, okay, because as we know, he also cut records in the 60s.
Yeah. 60s and 70s, The Hobbit. And yeah. It's, but he had a good singing voice at one point. I mean, he was, there's a story about him being asked after his bar mitzvah, he sang so well that he was invited to another boy's bar mitzvah to sing. So it's like, that's kind of ridiculous, but because I don't think he's a particularly good singer. I mean, it's not something I want to listen to much, those records. Maybe it's just the style. But yeah, no, he's done a lot of voice work with video games. Atlantis, The Lost Empire. There's a lot of audio dramatizations. He had his own company for that one point.
Those ones he did with John DeLancey are terrific.
Right, exactly. You know, like, yeah, doing some Arthur Conan Doyle and that kind of stuff.
The Time Machine, yeah.
Yeah, so he's got the great voice, so, you know, why not use it? And even as he went into, like, the downward phase, or just, like, the retirement or semi-retirement phase, you know, you can still do voice work pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept on doing those things. There's a Futurama episode as well that I've covered on Give Me That Star Trek. It's a lot of fun. So
Head in
a
Jar, yeah.
Yeah, the Head in a Jar.
I noticed that he does one of his few on-camera appearances during the late 90s and 2000s is on an episode of Becker, which of course starred Ted Danson. So that makes me, I was like, oh good, they were still friends, that he shows up on Ted Danson's TV show.
Yeah, and Terry Farrell, who was Dax on Deep Space Nine.
Oh, right.
So there's a lot of Star Trek in there. And you have like a recurring role on Fringe, which I've never watched that show.
No,
me neither. But it was a J.J. Abrams production, so it's because he liked working with J.J. Abrams on the new Trek films. He agreed to come in and then play a recurring character that appeared, I don't know, like more than half a dozen times over a few seasons.
Oh, yeah, Dr. William Bell. Yeah,
it says that's
so,
it. Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. Now we're going to go on to the, you know, perfect segue, the Star Trek, the new Star Trek films. And of course he plays Spock Prime in the original film of this iteration of Star Trek.
Right.
And I really can't imagine a better character to hand the series off than Spock. Really, it really is the perfect way. And I absolutely love him in Star Trek. I love that movie. I think it's a really great film. I think it's really fun. I think it does a service well to the characters. But boy, he's terrific in it. And there's just this warm glow emanating off the screen every time he's in it, because it's great. It's Spock. It's older Spock. It's a haunted Spock by his mistakes, but it's great. And the scenes he has with Zachary Quinto, again, you can sort of see you can almost see on screen the affection he has for this younger iteration of him.
Yeah. It's kind of logistically, he's the only original cast character who could have been in it, because he has to come from the time after Picard's adventures.
Right.
You know, so only Spock was still alive. Really? I mean, because Scotty, but, but I think Spock, but Spock is thematically, he's Star Trek. It has to be Spock. You know, there's so much gravitas there. And you wouldn't have gotten that with a Scotty, or even if you say that the William Shatner's Captain Kirk books happened that somehow he survives.
Lord.
He survives. He destroys the Borg. He does also, I mean, his Kirk is like a superhuman. let's say that happened. But no, you get Spock in these movies to really pass the torch. It could have just been, and maybe in a way, they might have just gone with, let's just reboot the thing. And it has no relationship. There's no like time change, historical change. But bringing it in and saying, well, it's part of the whole tapestry. It's in a parallel universe, like the mirror universe, you know, just like a similar universe that then Spock has a life, or Spock Prime, if we have to call him that, has a life in that universe as well. So he's living concurrently with his younger self. And that's sort of his fate.
Yeah.
Ultimately it is a good idea, and they pulled it off pretty well.
Yeah. Now, what was your, okay, I'll go first, actually. So when I went and saw Star Trek Into Darkness in the theater, I've seen every Star Trek movie in the theater. And I was dubious about them doing the Khan story, because I have all the stories that didn't really, you know, but okay. And my feelings about that movie are like, all right, I don't think it's great. And I think there's some stuff I like and whatever. But I will say, in the moment when I saw it in the theater, when Spock Prime shows up in Into Darkness, basically to answer a question, he's basically, you know, sort of the Wikipedia of that movie, because you've got young Spock saying, "Oh, who's this Khan guy?" And he calls old Spock. I absolutely hated it. I was white hot rage, hated it. Not because I wasn't happy to see Leonard Nimoy, of course I was, but I thought they had such a perfect handoff in the first film, that to bring him back to just be kind of like an editor's note just felt lazy and stupid. And I was like, no, why did you do this? Leave him alone. Now, okay, before I get into how I feel about it now or whatever, but how did you feel about it when you saw it that first time?
I did not see it in a theater. I saw it on DVD first. So there's that. I mean, I'd heard the reviews probably, and then it was easy to miss, and then I did miss it. So anyways, whatever. So that there wasn't like that shock moment necessarily. Being in the theater is always more intense, you know. Okay, well, that moment works in the way that, you know, in 2010, Nimoy had retired the character of Spock publicly. So he was handing it off to Zachary Quinto, saying, "You've got free reign with this. This is your character now." And I think the Star Trek film in 2009 made that point. You're absolutely right. It could have ended there. The fact that he is in this, and this becomes his new final film, where it would have been Star Trek before, is interesting thematically. And I hate to take a man's life and turn it into a theme, but nevertheless, what happens is that, you know, like, this is the Khan story. It is a remake of the story in which Spock died, regardless of the fact that he came back. The story where he died, famously died, is now being remade, and that is the actor's final film. So that there's something interesting in that. At the time, I didn't think much of the cameo. I mean, it is what it is, and it doesn't really pay off, because there's an unanswered question where Zachary Quinto says, or a younger Spock says, we beat him at great cost.
Yeah.
And then he goes, how? And then we don't see the answer.
No.
But then it has no bearing on the solution. There's nothing that Spock can say about how they beat Khan that then relates to anything they've done, either in the movie or could have done, because they just beat Khan because Khan was, you know, just pure ego, and he let himself be beat because it doesn't relate to, like, that Khan and this Khan have nothing to do with one another. I really hate Benedict Cumberbatch's take on Khan, or even the film's take on Khan, because they make him kind of, like, he speaks kind of robotically, and they kind of made him up to look like, I don't know, like a badly baked clone or something. So there's something, like, one of the things about J.J. Abrams is that I don't think he's a good director. He's a good producer, at least, but, you know, he's got an eye for spectacle. He's got
great at casting.
Great at casting. Yes. But what he doesn't have is an understanding of these franchises. I think his best film is Super 8 because it has nothing to do with other people's properties. I don't think he understands what these properties he's being handed, whether that's Mission Impossible or the Star Trek or Star Wars. I don't think he really understands what makes those properties and the characters within those properties, what makes fans love those properties. I don't think he has a good handle on that. So, so you get a lot of off-model things or like, oh, that doesn't pay off correctly, or that's not really Star Trek, or it's not really Star Wars, or it's not really Mission Impossible, whatever you want to pick. And I think remaking one of the greatest Star Trek films and remixing the greatest Star Trek movie moment, that's a non-starter. You shouldn't even try to do it.
Yep.
And then when you do it, it just feels like that last half hour feels like a parody of Star Trek II. So I don't think he really understood what that movie was about, what that scene was about, that moment was about, what those characters were about in that moment. And then that infects the whole film. Because otherwise, I mean, there's a fun ride. You get a lot of nice banter between the characters. I think that's what's mostly fun about it. But the further you go into it, the more you're going, oh, that Khan story shouldn't be retold.
Yeah. It bothered me at the time. Why? Why are you redoing them? Just do your own story. You've already established you can do this. Why are we doubling down on? Okay. And like I said, I was so mad that Nimoy wasn't allowed to end his film career on Thrusters on Full. And he just comes back as like, I'll just answer some questions for you. I was like, it just made me so mad. That said, I have since watched it again. Now, obviously, the scene doesn't bother me as much because it's not a surprise anymore. I've had years to kind of like live with it. And I'm like, okay, it's fun to see him one more time. But I will say, I feel like it is partially redeemed by the fact that they mention that he has then since passed away in Star Trek Beyond. Mm-hmm. They continue. They could have just said nothing. But I it feels a little like, okay, well, maybe these Kelvin timeline movies would have continually used Spock as a character, an old Spock, Spock Prime, I should say, as a character. And if that was their intention, then having him in the second one wasn't so weird because he would have been in the third one and maybe he would have been in the fourth one and if they had kept doing them. And the moment in that film in Star Trek Beyond, where Spock, young Spock, is looking at the cast photo of the original group, it does pack to me an emotional wallop that it's really over. It's really over. We obviously, DeForest Kelly's gone, James Doohan is gone, but now Spock is gone. Like Leonard Nimoy is, we know as in moviegoers, Leonard Nimoy is gone. And so it almost feels like, okay, the cameo in 2 is redeemed a little bit by it being mentioned at least in 3 that the death of Spock Prime means something to the younger Spock. And so I don't hate it the way I did at the time because I'm like, okay, they did something with it in real life later on that I appreciate. And again, I can just that, again, the feeling of him looking at that photo and just we're like, wow, all the accumulated memories of all the Star Trek movies of me growing up with Leonard Nimoy as this character, it's over. This is it. And that's okay. We're putting a period at the end of the sentence. I still maybe wish they had left it alone, but at the same time, okay, it's a reminder that, yeah, Leonard Nimoy is just hardly you ever going to see in history a marriage of actor and role so beloved between those two things together. That it's something truly special. And so as a final film, like, okay, good. He got to go out as Spock and everyone got to see him one last time as Spock. So great. You know, so it bothers me a lot less than it did at the time.
Sure. I mean, the alternative was maybe he has a bigger role in this. That might have been, mm-hmm. More satisfying than mm-hmm. just a cameo.
Yeah.
Especially after he'd retired the character, supposedly. So I don't know how they brought him back in, because it's not a necessary scene.
No.
So maybe it's like, let's get some Nimoy, as much Nimoy as we can, as often as we can, because we're not going to have these actors with us forever.
Yeah.
And maybe Abrams, called in this kind of favor or something. I don't know. But at least, yes, we get to speak to about his final film, and it is a Star Trek film. It is a Spock. It's not a Spock vehicle. He's at least playing Spock in it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to ever be so reductive as like, oh well, it's this is great because this other thing is lesser. I don't never want to do that in any context, especially on the show. But I feel like, you know, the love that people have for William Shatner is wrapped up with, of course, his role as Kirk. And there's parts of that we know about William Shatner that are not as beloved, you know. But the affection that people have for him is because he's this icon and because he played Kirk. But I feel like this is, it's a rare moment where the love of the actor, Leonard Nimoy, is equal to the love of the character, Spock. You know, there, people love Spock, but they love Leonard Nimoy too. They love him, not just him as Spock. They love him, which is why he got to be funny on The Simpsons and why he got to play, again, a voice in a Transformers movie and a voice in a Land of the Lost movie. And he got to, like, there's something about that, and that's rare. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about. You got the sense he always gave his best no matter what he was doing, even if it was, you know, Seizure, the Kathy Morris story, or it was Star Trek, or it was an episode of, you know, Night Gallery, or whatever it was. He brought a lot to it. He brought as much to it as he could when he was a younger actor and he didn't have a lot of power. He brought as much as he could, not a lot. But when he got a little more power and he could use that, he did it effectively. And that's, you know, he ended up with a very interesting career, diverse. He got to direct some things. Again, his directing career probably did not go the way he ever intended, but he got to direct a couple of classics that'll, you know, be loved forever. And it's a fine filmography as both, again, actor and director. It's a really, really great career to look back on. And so I'm glad we got to talk about this, Siskoid. I mean, Leonard Nimoy was not somebody I would have normally thought to ever cover on the show, but I know, like, you know, you're such an expert on Star Trek. I thought, oh, this will be perfect. So, you know, it's just, thank you for doing this. This was just great to talk about the Leonard Nimoy's career.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm surprised I didn't get more emotional. You can hear it in my voice. Man, there's something about film performance more than anything else that somehow, like, those stories just get to me. And I think Nimoy was one of only two actors that their deaths actually hit me.
Yeah.
The other one being Liz Sladen from Doctor Who. So I'm like Shag in that respect. Mm-hmm. That really hurt us. But Nimoy is the other one.
I've said in other contexts and other shows, I don't get emotional at movies. I just don't, no matter what the subject matter is, I just don't get teary-eyed. It's just not the way I react to films. But I get a little, I do get a little moist in my eye during the scene with him and Mark Lenard at the end of Star Trek IV.
Oh yeah,
no, they say sure. Goodbye.
Love it
because these two men cannot say what they probably in their heart want to say because of who they are, and I think that scene is absolutely marvelous. I mean, that scene of just most kind, and you know, your friends are people of good character, and just it's absolutely beautiful, beautifully directed by Nimoy and beautifully acted by Nimoy and Mark Lenard. It's just it's probably my single favorite Star Trek moment in a movie that's my favorite. That's probably my favorite moment from that movie. For a movie that's so funny, that dramatic scene is probably my favorite part of the whole thing. It's just, it's so beautifully done. So again, Siskoid, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. This was a really fun talk. So why don't you tell people where they can find you here on the network?
Here on the network. It's the same address. If you're interested in this actor and others like him, well, of course, give me that Star Trek. The next episode comes out soon with our friend Chris Franklin. We're talking about Mego toys.
Oh, that'll be fun.
So we're talking about your beloved Gorn. We mentioned you. I remember.
He's looking at me here over my computer as I'm recording this. little Gorn doll.
So we do mention him. And otherwise, you know, the shows are Who's Editing, Let's Roll, Oh Hot Moo or Not. 0 Hour Strikes is just finishing. I mean, there's one episode. The episode is tomorrow.
<That's>, wow.
As the podcast flies, is going to be tomorrow. And after that, we start on a run of FW team up. So there's plenty. I do plenty on the network. Not as much as Rob, but plenty. Plenty.
It's absolutely true. So, again, thank you so much for doing this. And, of course, everybody, you can find back episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies over on Twitter, at FadeOutPod. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script, so it's time to fade out.
Thrusters on full.